I think if you don't think it's too early, we might as well start. I came early to try and master this gadget here, which, as you'll see in a second, I have completely mastered now. So everyone will be able to see exactly what I'm writing about. Can everyone hear me all right? I'm really appreciative of you coming in the lunch hour to hear these lectures. I mean, so I do hope you keep coming. I hope you don't mind if I carry on in this lecture theatre, though, because I just feel it has a better rapport than if I move to the really big one in the Peacock. I mean, I'm sure that's good for other purposes, but to actually get to know people, I think it's better for me to stay here. So I hope you'll forgive all the surrounding difficulties, which involves people sitting on the floor and damaging their backs. So, I mean, there are certain problems, but I think this is a better atmosphere, really. If you remember last time, I just introduced the issue, basic issue, really, of this whole course, which is, what is the impact of modernity for us? We live in a kind of spaceship era, in a sense, in which I tried to show last time. Modern industrial civilization has set us off on a trajectory which none of us fully understand. Mainly because that trajectory, seems to me anyway, does not just recapitulate past history. There are fundamental differences between industrial civilization, between the kind of gigantic global experiment that it's created for us, and previous forms of civilization. Now, you will find when you start to read about these things, there are divergence of views. Not everyone agrees with me. But my view, for what it's worth, is that industrial civilization, Western industrial civilization, as it's spread across the world, has distinctive differences from any previous type of civilization. It has created problems for us, and it has created opportunities for us, which are massively greater, I think, both the problems and the opportunities, than those generated by any previous type of more agrarian civilization. We're all struggling with the residue of the two great revolutions I described last time, the Industrial Revolution and Political Revolution, epitomized by the democratic revolutions of the American and French revolutions onwards. Now, Marx was the first great theorist of modernity, and that's why I'm starting this course by a reassessment of Marx's writings. Along the way, I'd like to try to present a clear idea of why Marx's writings were so interesting. Now, Marx spent most of his life, like many people here, including me, sitting behind a desk, reading books and attempting to write them. I mean, Marx never had an academic job of any consequence. I mean, I feel if he had have done, the history of the world would have been quite different, but he didn't have. He labored for most of his lifetime in obscurity as a scholar. However, Marx, and this is sort of a crucial starting point, I think, really, was never just an academic. That is, Marx did not want just to understand the world. Marx wanted to change the world. One of the most famous aphorisms in Marx's writings is the one you'll be familiar with. Philosophers have interpreted the world. The point is to change it. Philosophers have interpreted the world. The point, Marx said, is to change it. And change it he did. If you look at the impact of Marx's writings, there are two quite amazing elements to that impact, which I want to concentrate on in this lecture and the next one. First is, Marxism became part of what modern history is. Marx's writings and the subsequent impact of Marxist movements have shaped 20th century history. Marxism, for most of the 20th century, was a much more powerful ideological force, I would say, probably than any religion. It had enormous world historical impact. At least a third of the population until 1989 lived in countries claiming affiliation to Marxist doctrines. By any criterion, this is massive world historical success for Marx's attempt to change the world. The world did not change as he anticipated, and we'll be looking at reasons why. Second amazing thing about Marx and his impact, I think, related to the first, is its collapse. because although Marx's writings are Marxism in its various forms, and I should emphasize there have been many forms of Marxism, you can make at least as many things of Marxism as you can of Christianity, given the diverse sources from which Marx drew. There have been many forms of Marxism. The most extraordinary fact, I think, is that Marxism, in a certain sense, dominated world history through most of the 20th century, at least much of it, but suddenly it's all collapsed. No one, I think, fully anticipated the revolutions of 1989, which looked like bourgeois revolutions. They looked like the revolutions which initiated the period of modernity, not the revolutions that Marx anticipated coming into being. Why did Marxism collapse? It seems to have collapsed as an intellectual system. Why more broadly did the communist societies disintegrate, at least the communist societies of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union? And more generally, why is socialism dead, if it is indeed dead? Because socialism, of course, stretches more broadly than Marx's own writings themselves. I'll be dealing with those issues primarily, the second level of issues, that is, why did all this collapse, in the following lecture. For this lecture, I want to concentrate on the origins of Marx's world historical impact. Why did Marx's writings have the unbelievable impact they've had on 20th century world history? Now you can suggest various answers to that. One possible answer is that Marxism was a kind of religion. Many people who have been critical of Marx and Marxism in the 20th century have argued that Marxism derived its appeal from its quasi-religious characteristics. It was a kind of surrogate religion. And indeed, you can see some affinities between Marx's ideas and those of at least some Christian religions. There have, of course, been alliances between Marxism and Christianity in, for example, the 60s and 70s, as a direct kind of allegiance of Christian Marxism. That was an established fact for a certain period. Marx's ideas do have a kind of millennial quality to them, which that quality seems quite present in Christian traditions in the West, not so much, I think, in other religions. And people like Karl Popper, for example, probably, for all I know, in this very lecture theatre, have been prone to compare Marxism and religion and suggest that they are both all-embracing forms of wish fulfillment which can't be empirically tested and are therefore non-scientific. Their appeal comes, as it were, from their non-scientific basis. Now, I have to say, Karl Popper or not, I think this view is wrong. I think, as I said, there are some affinities between at least certain versions of Marx's writings and religion, but I don't think this is the reason why, the main reason why Marx's thought has been so successful, or was so successful. And I don't think that the comparison is all that accurate. There are only certain elements of it that are accurate. It's a much better way of understanding Marx's writings, a much better way of understanding also ultimately why they've collapsed, is to say that Marx was a child of the Enlightenment, and what Marx tried to do was to radicalize certain Enlightenment themes. The Enlightenment essentially was against religion, as Marx was against religion. The Enlightenment wanted to understand the world in order to change the world. It wanted to understand the world in order to rationally control it. That is the tradition in which at least I would situate Marx. Marx believed fundamentally, I think, something which is immediately attractive and plausible, especially if you come from Enlightenment traditions. He believed that until recent times, we have been the prisoners of our own history. Human beings have been the playthings of historical forces, including religious beliefs, which they did not fully understand. As we come to understand ourselves, as we come to grasp our own history, Marx thought, we will be in a position consciously to make history and consciously to control our own destiny. That is an Enlightenment premise. Marx, I would take to be the most radical inheritor of Enlightenment, actually, or at least certain strands of Enlightenment. Marx thought The point of understanding our history rationally is to control our history in the future. And that's what Marx wanted to do. He wanted to organize human society in such a way as to realize key human values in the conscious control of our own history and the conscious control of nature. There are very, very powerful reasons why this has not happened. They, to my mind, they are absolutely crucial to understanding the late 20th century condition of humanity. But it is not simply because Marx was wrong, it's because there are certain problems in Enlightenment itself, which have only become apparent, I think, in the relatively recent period, and which in a certain sense the collapse of communism and the demise of socialism epitomizes. If we're to look for the appeal of Marx's writings, why they've had such influence, I would prefer to look and to consider more directly their intellectual power. Marx, as I've just said, gave a certain cogent expression to key ideas of Enlightenment that was already appealing. Let us make history consciously, not unconsciously. But Marx also, I think, produced an intellectual scheme of great power that did provide a way of understanding modernity and did provide, I think, a highly cogent and coherent interpretation of where modernity might lead us in a more self-consciously organized history. Therefore, for part of this lecture, I want to concentrate on demonstrating what I take to be the inherent logical power of Marx's scheme for analyzing history and social change. If you can't grasp that, I don't think you have any way really of understanding why Marxism has had the impact it has had, at least until this recent period. Now, Marx referred to his scheme of history, he referred to his attempt to situate modernity in a wider historical scheme, famously, as the materialist conception of history, the materialist conception of history. Marx never seems to have used the term historical materialism, let alone dialectical materialism. These terms appear to have been introduced by Engels, partly independent of Marx himself. Marx, it seemed, to prefer to talk of the materialist conception of history. Now, the first thing I think one has to understand, grasp about this, is that Marx was not a materialist in the sense in which you might think that term, sense in which that term has. Marx definitively did not believe in materialistic values. He did not believe in the idea, I think, which has now become the generating idea of our civilization, that economic growth and economic values are the prime values according to which we live. If that's what materialism means, Marx was radically hostile to materialism, and the whole body of his writings concern an attack upon materialism in that sense. Marx thought that modern capitalism means the blind rule of what he thought were false economic laws. This was a submission of humanity and human ethical values to the values of the market. Marx was above all a critic of a society based on purely economic values and devoted at least purely and simply to economic growth. He was not a materialist in that sense. When Marx spoke of his materialist conception of history, he meant a certain interpretation of how history is made, and especially of how history is made before we get conscious grasp of it as human beings. So let me work through what the materialist conception of history was to try and convey to you its integrated intellectual power before moving on to say how Marx applied it to his diagnosis of our society, in other words, capitalistic modernity. I can do this by just going through it in terms of a number of points. I should stress this is my gloss on Marx. This is not Marx himself speaking. All these points logically connect with one another, and they do make a scheme of considerable power. First premise of Marx's historical materialism is that human beings, if you can read my writing, must produce to survive. Production is the first exigency of any human society. The first thing you must do is you must make sure that you can survive materially in your surrounding environment. Now, of course, animals have to do this as well. It's not only human society which is based upon material production, because animals need food, animals need some kind of shelter, animals need to be able to survive in the physical world. Now, a key point of Marx's view of humanity is that the way in which human beings survive is radically different from the way in which the animals survive. According to Marx, human beings are radically different from the animals in the sense in which they do not have instincts. Animals, when they produce routinely over perhaps many thousands of years doing the same thing because they're imprinted to survive in the environment in a certain way. Bees, for example, build hives much the same now as they presumably did thousands of years ago. Birds build nests, ants build colonies in much the same way as they did thousands of years ago. Human beings, Marx says, are definitively not like that. Human beings are born to be free. Human beings are born to freedom with all the problems and, again, the possibilities which this involves. We do not have instincts. We have a certain number of basic drives, but we are not patterned to survive in the world. We have to learn to survive in the world. This means, Marx thought, that we have to actively relate to nature. Animals adapt to nature. The distinctive feature of human history is that we struggle with nature in such a way as to attempt actively to master it, and in so doing, create the possibility of mastering our own history. We must have an active relationship to nature. We are inherently creative beings, Marx stresses again and again, especially in his early writings. The creativity of human beings is epitomized by the very fact that human beings have a history. And Marx is interesting on this point, I think. Animals do not have a history in the sense in which human beings do. They, of course, have a long-term evolutionary history, but the species of animals tend to repeat what they do from generation to generation. Human beings have an active, mobile history, which is driven by our active relationship to the material world in which we exist. We have no choice but to be free as human beings. We have no choice but to master nature in our attempt to survive in nature. That's why human history has an inherent dynamism. Human history is a history not just of economic development, but of cultural advance, Marx says. This is driven by our necessarily creative adaptations to the world around us. Second premise Marx makes, production for human beings is always social. And Marx called this the social relations of production. In any human society, Marx argued, human beings must collaborate in order to survive. No human being survives as an independent, isolated producer. Only Robinson Crusoe ever did that, and Robinson Crusoe was a highly artificial, fictional story. Human beings must collaborate to survive. The relations of production, Marx thought, are therefore the basic infrastructure of every society. Every society must have some kind of production system. This must involve cooperation. It always involves some degree of interdependence between different producers. So, for example, in a feudal society, the relations of production are basically agrarian. They basically depend upon farming, agricultural production. In a society like ours, the relations of production involve factory production, exchange on markets, the production of goods for markets, and so forth. Marx thought, and surely in some sense he was right about this, you can see this by the very terminologies we use. If you speak of agrarian society, where you're showing that society is characterized by the way in which it produces, the way in which it lives. If you speak of industrial society or industrial capitalism, you're showing that our society is heavily structured by the way in which we order our relationship to production, nature, and each other. So the social relations of production for Marx always form a kind of basic structure of a society, a sort of infrastructure of a society, as Marx sometimes called it. It's there that you find the kind of basic imprint which lends itself to many other institutions within a society. An agrarian society will simply not look like an industrial one. That's because the production form is different in the two types of society. Now, Marx argued that in... Oh dear, I thought I'd mastered this gadget, but I've lost all the flipping pens here. Oh. Marx argued that in the relations of production, there is one distinctive dimension which is important. And this he referred to as ownership versus non-ownership of property or the means of production. In many types of human society, although not all, Marx argued, if you look at the infrastructure of society, a key structuring dimension is control and power. Control and power tend to be yielded by who owns the means of production, whether these be factories, machines, or whether they be land, fields, and so forth, and who does not. In any class society, Marx argued, this kind of division becomes crucial. Now, key part of what Marx has to say, and again very interesting part, is that not all forms of human society have been class societies. In the earliest forms of human society, tribal society, hunting and gathering society, things were owned in common, Marx says. The social relations of production did not involve a dimension of inequality, of some people owning the means of production, some people not. Engels famously described this as primitive communism. In primitive communism, you do not yet have a division into those who own the means of production and those who don't. Production is carried on communally. Anthropologists here will know of, say, many hunting and gathering societies. You go out and you kill yourself a succulent pig with your bow and arrow. You may get the heart of the pig and the very nice bits of the pig, like the entrails and the eyes, but the rest of the pig has to be given away to the community. These are largely interdependent communities where you do not have class division, because you do not yet, as yet, have this division in history between ownership versus non-ownership, the means of production. Now, the interesting thing about this, an important thing to remember about it, is that Marx did not admire hunting and gathering societies. Marx did not admire primitive communism. Marx was not an admirer of the local village commune. Many people who have called themselves socialists, or particularly anarchists, have been admirers of the local commune, of collaborative local production. This was true of the movements of the 1960s, for example, many of which wished to return to pre-class societies. Marx never had that wish, for reasons I'll mention in more detail later. Marx spoke of rural idiocy in such societies. He thought such societies were at a fairly low level of development, mainly because they live close to the breadline. You don't have divisions in these societies because there isn't enough that's produced to create such divisions. There simply isn't enough wealth to create such divisions. Only when you get wealth created do you get divisions between those who own the means of production and those who don't. However, Marx thought that since the earliest forms of society show that class is not inevitable, they show that division of between those who have and those who do not have are not inevitable because they haven't existed through all periods of history, the same thing can apply to the future. Primitive communism is a classless society. There can again be a classless society of the future, but that classless society of the future, Marx argued, will be based upon abundance, not on scarcity. Primitive communism is based upon scarcity. The classless society of the future will be based upon wealth. More wealth, perhaps, than anyone can conceivably use. More about that in the next lecture. Next time, it's also a very interesting theme. Fourth, as been following from what I'm saying, I think, item 3 gives the key to the class structure. There are only certain types of class society in history, but class is defined fundamentally in terms of ownership versus non-ownership of the means of production. What are the main class societies in history? Well, Marx had, again, a lot of very interesting things to say about these. First of all, there is the ancient mode of production, which is the classical world, Rome, classical Greece, based on slave owning, that kind of system. In Europe, there is feudalism. Subsequent to feudalism, there is capitalism. They are the three main types of class society that Marx recognized in history. To understand Marx's notion of class, you must recognize that class is objective, it's structured into the economic system, it is not a matter just of class consciousness. Classes are inherently in conflict with one another, because the more one class group gets, the less others by definition can get. The more, therefore, for example, the feudal aristocracy is able to build its fancy castles and live a life of some opulence, the more the peasantry are condemned to a life of relative misery. Class conflict is a structural property of class societies. And Marx thought this was true of capitalism. We'll be talking about capitalism in a few minutes, but Marx thought this was true of our society. Class division and class conflict are structured into modern industrial capitalism. It makes an enormous difference whether or not this is true, and I'll be considering it later in these lectures. We do seem to see around us, in the late 20th century, a kind of global polarization between a cosmopolitan capital class, which is globally mobile, and at the bottom, large numbers of unemployed people with widening degrees of inequality. This is what the late 20th century looks like. Is this a generalization of Marx's observations about capitalism, or is it not? A lot of very important things, as I'll be suggesting later in the lectures, stem from one's answer to this particular question. Anyway, for Marx himself, class is structured into the nature of society. The only way in which you can overcome class is by changing the nature of society, especially by changing capitalist society, about which Marx also had a lot of very cogent things to say. Marx thought that in the West you have a development from the ancient mode of production through feudalism to capitalism. These are three different kinds of class system. In the East, however, you have something quite different, which Marx called sometimes the Asiatic mode of production. And he thought as distinct from the West. Again, very, very important what Marx had to say about this. He sometimes also called it Oriental despotism. By this he meant China, India, Japan, and did he not mean Russia? Very significant world historical terms. The Asiatic mode of production is a kind of frozen class society, Marx thought. Whereas in the West, class is the dynamic of social change, the ancient world collapsed because it could not contain its class struggles, Marx thought. Slavery meant that it could not become a capitalistic society. It simply collapsed as a result of its inner contradictions. In the East, Marx thought, you never get a class society emerging. You get a quasi-class society, which is kind of stuck without much historical change. In the Asiatic mode of production, partly because the Asian societies are in large land masses, Marx thought you often get irrigation schemes as the basis of production. These become controlled by an early form of state apparatus, which, for reasons I won't go into, effectively inhibits any further change. Therefore, Chinese society infrastructurally stays the same for 2,000 years, Marx says. India has many changes, like China, on the political level, But infrastructurally, its economy looks the same for a period of some 2,000 years. Much the same for Japan, Marx thought. Only, according to Marx anyway, with the global impact of capitalism does the Asiatic mode of production become broken up. There is no inherent dynamism in traditional China, in traditional Japan, or in traditional India. These are not societies, Marx thought, which could have produced industrial capitalism indigenously. What happens is that because industrial capitalism is a voraciously expanding system, again for reasons I'll go into in a minute, as capitalism expands, as the Western industrialists and merchants spread across the world, they destroy, through colonialism and other means, the traditional structures of China, India, and elsewhere. These only join world history under the impact of Western capitalism. I'd like you to note a few important questions about all this, very, very significant questions, whether Marx was right or wrong about this. For Marx, China and the other Asian civilizations, as for Hegel, are not part of history until they become part of Western history. Is this correct? My view is not correct, in fact. China seems to have had, for a long period, prior to the rise of the West, very strong sources of inner dynamism. Economic, cultural, and political seems to have been a much greater civilization than Marx was able to acknowledge. Same thing true of India. Ethnocentrism, Eurocentrism is kind of bound up, I think, with Marx's position on these issues. Second key aspect of it, what was going on in Russia? Was Russia a bureaucratically dominated society of an Asiatic type when the Russian Revolution occurred within it, or was it not? In other words, did what happened in Russia after 1917 bear witness to the fact that it never became a capitalistic society and therefore could never have a successful revolution because it belonged to the system of Oriental despotism? There was a famous book written claiming that this was true, you might have heard of, by Karl Wittfogel, called Oriental Despotism. He claims that Marx was basically right about the Asiatic mode of production, but he was wrong about Marxism was wrong about what happened in Russia, because Russia was precisely one of these type of societies. It could not breed a capitalistic socialist revolution because it never was a capitalistic society. It became a bureaucratic, repressive state, as Oriental despotism always was traditionally. That is the argument. It's sort of using Marx against Marx. Now, oh sorry, I've gone off the bottom of the page here. Thought I'd masked it, but I haven't. Oh well. Just going to rip this page off here. Fifthly, if you have all these class societies in history, you can ask the question, how the hell do they hold together? If there is class division, which is intrinsic to ancient society, feudalism, capitalism at a minimum, why do these societies hold together for relatively long periods of time? Why do people put up with their oppression? Why do people, for example, who are serfs in a feudal society, accept the domination of the aristocracy? Marx had an important, very influential answer to this. The answer to this is the role of ideology. Class societies hop together because the dominant class, whether consciously or otherwise, is able to legitimize its position of domination through control of culture and idea systems. Ideology means control of such idea systems. Thus in feudalism, for example, where the aristocracy and the gentry, the dominant class, what are the ideas you find? Well, you find ideas of blood right, that only certain people are qualified to rule. You find ideas of feudal fealty, feudal obligation. You find a hierarchical type religion, Catholicism, in Marx's eyes, backing all this up. This explains why people put up with their oppression. They do not see it as oppression. In any class society, you must have an ideology which persuades people that what is a social state of affairs and can't be changed is a natural state of affairs. Feudal ideology persuaded people this was how the world had to be. The division between the person in the castle, the person in the lowly village gate. Ideology does all this. Now, Marx had a particular view of religion relating to this, which is worth noting, I think. Marx thought religion was the basis of ideology, certainly in feudal and ancient society. And you might think that Marx therefore had a hostile and unsophisticated attitude to religion, I think. Because famously, in his early writings, Marx says, you will have seen this in the Daily Express, if you haven't seen it anywhere else, religion is the opium of the people. Religion is the opium of the people. Suggests that religion is a drug which simply holds people in their place, as it did, for example, in a feudal society. Marx's thought on religion, I'd suggest, is much more subtle and interesting than that. Because immediately after Marx says religion is the opium of the people, he says religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. Religion is the heart of a heartless world, Marx says. Religion is the heart of a heartless world. Both moving statements, I think. What do they mean? Well, they mean that religion expresses key human values which themselves have a dynamic quality. I think Marx is saying here, religion is not just a way of holding people in their place, it's very much a mixed thing. Religion holds out values which can inspire social movements. Religion makes possible, holds out to us values, even though they're in mystified form, which we could ourselves realize. We could realize some of the values of Christianity on this earth, Marx says in his early writings. I think this is exceptionally important in understanding Marx's thought. Not just his relationship to religion, but the phrase, heart of a heartless world, sigh of the oppressed creature. Because Marxism now has collapsed, and you should ask yourself, who now will hear the sigh of the oppressed creature? Where will we find the heart of a heartless world? Because it doesn't seem, these things don't seem to lie in the solutions which Marx anticipated. Now, all this is so far a static scheme, and you have to ask where the dynamism comes from. Where is the dynamic movement in history? Again, Marx had a very good theory of this too. He argues that in any type of class society, like ancient society, feudalism or capitalism, you first of all start off with an existing set of relations of production, an existing infrastructure, economic infrastructure. Changes go on in the society which gradually diverge from that infrastructure. Marx called these changes in the forces of production. They're primarily economic, technological developments at the core of a society. As they diverge more and more, so you get a process ultimately of revolutionary change when the whole thing, the whole pattern repeats itself again. Let's look at how this worked in the transition from feudalism to capitalism. But it also works crucially in the transition between capitalism and socialism for Marx. Feudal society in its origins, the early form of relations of production in feudal society was based upon decentered agrarian production. Feudalism was a localized agrarian system involving a class structure linking aristocracy and gentry to serfdom. That's classical feudalism. However, Marx says, because of certain economic developments within feudalism, especially the development of war and trade, you gradually got the emergence of cities within feudal society. Cities were based upon a mode of production different from agrarian feudalism. In the cities, people started to produce for markets, they set up workshops, they started trading, they developed a merchant attitude to the world, a mercantile trading attitude to the world. The cities, therefore, were a kind of growing enclave within feudal society, contradicting the relations of production of the dominant form of classical feudalism. in the towns, you had the emergence of a market society, quite different from the traditional bonded society of agrarian feudalism. Now, Marx argued in any period of social change, a key part of the materialist conception of history, first of all, you get economic transformation, as we'll see happening in feudalism. From that, you get political transformation, and from that, you get ideological change or ideological transformation. Economically, the cities, as they developed in feudal society, came to set up an alternative to the feudal order itself economically, which eventually became a political challenge to feudalism and an ideological challenge to it too. In the cities, you have a new class of people emerging who called themselves citizens. That has root in the term city or town. Burghers also has root in the term city or town, or bourgeoisie. Bourgeoisie also has root, same root exactly, in the term meaning people who live in the city, people who live in the town. In the cities or towns, therefore, you get a new class system emerging with people who start to manufacture for markets. They are a new bourgeois class, industrialist class, who set themselves up economically in opposition to feudalism. Economic change leads to political change. Marx argued the origins of the French Revolution, and indeed the American Revolution, convoluted way, can be explained as the new economic class constituting a political challenge to the existing order. French Revolution did not come out of nowhere. It was a challenge of a newly emerging bourgeois class to the feudal order, which in that revolution overthrew it politically. Political revolution follows on economic transformation. It goes along with ideological revolution. The new ideas of the bourgeoisie, the new ideas of the emergent ruling class, were based upon notions of democracy, of freedom of the individual, not on the old ideas of feudal fealty and feudal bondage. Why? Well, for Marx, because a market society presumes individual freedom. You must have the possibility of negotiating a contract if you are a worker or you are an employer. You could not do that within feudal society. Democracy, liberal democracy, therefore, for Marx, is still ideological. It is the ideology of a newly emerging society. And that emerging society is precisely industrial capitalism. Industrial capitalism. That is our kind of society. That is modernity. Industrial capitalism emerges out of the convergence of these three forms of revolution. Now, if Marx's theory is correct, and this is fundamental part of what he has to say, this scheme of divergence between the relations and forces of production must also apply to the history of capitalist society, not just to feudalism, but to capitalism. How does it work? For Marx, it explains the inner dynamism, really, of a capitalistic society. What is capitalism in Marx's theory? Capitalism in its early phases in Marx's theory involves, a number of distinct elements, most of which are still around in our society now, and that's why it is now global industrial capitalism. First of all, capitalism, of course, involves the accumulation of capital. What is capital? Well, capital is disposable wealth. Capital means money, it means factories, it means machines, and ultimately it means land. But the important thing, what makes capital different from an asset, is that capital is disposable. You can transform it into other forms of capital. The accumulation of capital is the first condition of the emergence of an industrial capitalist society of the kind in which we live. Marx agreed with perfectly orthodox political economists on this. He did not agree about the other characteristics of his theory, which were completely different, or in some respects completely different. Capitalist society, the emergence of capitalism for Marx, involves the dominance of the commodity. You can't understand Marx's theory unless you understand this notion. A commodity is anything you buy and sell on the market. Now, we're so accustomed to buying and selling things on markets that we take it for granted that we live in a commodified society. But Marx completely correctly points out this is a massive difference with any previous kind of society. Our society is the first society where everything in principle becomes a commodity, because everything in principle can be bought and sold on the market and can be exchanged against anything else. You can calculate, for example, the price of a holiday for two in Ibiza against the price of buying three or four new shirts, and you have no problem in doing so. This was never possible in pre-existing forms of society. Our society is dominated by the commodity form. No doubt whatsoever that Marx was correct about this. Consider land, for example. In a feudal society, you couldn't buy and sell land for the most part. It was simply within the family or owned communally. In our society, nearly all land can be bought and sold. The only remnant of the old common forms of land are the common lands that you find, for example, in parts of London. Clapham Common, other common land, that kind of very reshrunken version of what used to be the norm. We can buy and sell everything. And Marx thought this is an amazing characteristic of a society because it's intrinsically dehumanizing. If you can buy and sell anything against anything else, your only measure of value seems to be its exchange value, its commodity value on markets. Is this a way to live? Marx thought not. Modern economic theory does not agree with him, for reasons I'll be discussing in a subsequent lecture, and modern economic theory, to a large degree, but not completely, has some right on its side in this. Marx thought that we have become a society, however, of commodities. Crucially, thirdly, this is a big difference with other theories, wage labour becomes a commodity. Marx drew attention to, again, something completely correct and historically unique about modern capitalism. That is that most of us do not produce from the land. Only a small proportion of people, as said last time, produce enough for everybody. What happens to everyone else? Well, everyone else has to sell their labour on a market, their labour power on a market to employers, whether that employer be the state or individual business organisations. Everyone sitting in this room either does or will get their income, probably, from selling their labour power to an employer. That is how we live. Our society depends upon massive, massive division of labour and labour markets. No society has ever lived like this before. For Marx, this was in turn the key to the class structure of modern capitalism, because the basic class structure is a class structure which separates the owners of industrial and financial capital, who can get a living from their property, from the mass of the population who are in wage work or have to sell themselves on labour markets in order to get a living. In sort of traditional terminology, this was bourgeoisie or capitalists versus proletariat or wage labouring class. Very important, crucial thing, because it means this is how Marx shows that capitalism is intrinsically a class system. It works only through the fluidity of capital compared to the relatively static nature of wage labour, of people who have to get a job in order to get a living. It's so central to our lives, getting a job, that you think nothing of it. I mean, I was just talking to you beginning this lecture about what job you might get, and we just assume you've got to get a job, but no one lived like that before. It's a massive historical change when everyone has to get a job. In other words, what you do, you sell yourself. You sell your labour power, your credentials, your education. Being at the LSE gives you a great advantage in the labour market. I'm pleased to reaffirm to everybody here. You have many advantages in selling your labour power if you get an education, but basically you do the same thing as a street sweeper. You must sell yourself to somebody else who provides you with a source of income. This is the basis of the class system. Fourthly and finally, equally crucially, capitalism involves the separation of producer and consumer. And Marx thought an awful lot stemmed from this. In all previous types of society, people are producing for other people whom they know. If you go to a local market, the farmer knows for whom he's producing. He's producing for local people. He knows what their needs are. He is able to gear production to known human need. Capitalism, for the first time in human history, decisively breaks with producer and consumer. This break in economic theory, I think, orthodox, non-Marxist economic theory, is the basis of the efficiency of capitalism as a system. Marx agreed with that to some part, but for Marx, it also introduces a strong irrationality into the way in which we live. Because, for us, we no longer produce in relation to known human need. A capitalist society is not a society where production is carried on in relation to known human need, according to Marx anyway. A capitalist society is a society which produces, as long as you can go on making a profit, you carry on producing and expanding. When you can't make a profit anymore, you stop producing the good in question. The tie between production and human need is broken. It is only market relationships, particularly the pursuit of profit, in an impersonal marketplace that ties producer and consumer. For Marx, some of the most irrational forms of our way of life stem from this dislocation. He wanted to see a society which is not dominated by economic onrush, where it isn't purely market forces which govern our lives, where production is again reunited to known human need and the consumption. He thought a socialist society would do that. It can't do that, but he thought it could do. I don't think it can do, but he thought it could do. In our kind of society, we don't have that relationship. Therefore, Marx thought, I mean, this would be how Marx explains what happens to you when you walk along the Kingsway in the morning. We all come in our, well, I don't know, in my case, fairly expensive shirts and quite nice ties and suits, carrying our little bags with money in our pocket and checkbooks in our briefcases. We pass by people sleeping in corners of the Kingsway building right adjacent to the LSE who have apparently no money to live on. Marx thought capitalism produces this kind of society. It's a society in which people need many things, but those needs are not addressed. So you have a society which has enormous productive potential, but where that productive potential is not utilized. You have a society with millions of people unemployed, where people still need goods. What is the logic of such an economic situation? Marx thought it was both illogical, irrational, and would be changed by the course of human history. In the next lecture, I'll explain why, and also why the dream went sour. Thanks very much.